From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Natasha Moore.
And I'm Simon Smart. And just a heads up before we get started today, there are some topics we'll be discussing that may not be suitable for children. So if you have kids around, you might want to put on some headphones or perhaps catch up on the podcast later.
Gender and gender identity is one of the most fraught issues of our time. Gender stereotypes are everywhere, and they go back at least to earliest childhood.
What are little boys made of? Snips and snails and puppy dog tails. That's what little boys are made of. What are little girls made of? Sugar and spice and all things nice. That's what little girls are made of.
I remember rather enjoying this rhyme as a kid, partly because of the vibe, of course, that girls are great and boys are horrid. That really appealed to my 7-year-old brain. But as for many stereotypes, the accuracy of its picture of gender is a bit dubious.
Yeah, and there's been some great work done in recent decades breaking down some of the more arbitrary and often harmful perceptions we have around gender. But of course, gender is still a thing. It's still important in lots of ways. But increasingly, this is contested ground.
This is partly because of growing awareness about a group of people for whom none of this is straightforward, those who come under the category transgender. We haven't talked about transgender issues on Life and Faith before, but we think it's about time we did. We know it's a controversial topic on all sides, and we want to approach it with clarity and compassion, but it's important to have the conversation, especially because it's bound up with much broader questions of identity, sexuality, and culture.
Yes, in 2014, Time magazine made the bold claim that when it comes to our understanding of gender identity, society had reached a definitive tipping point.
There's been a fundamental change in the way I think we as society have begun to look at the whole area of sexuality and gender. However, I was studying gender in Hawaii in 1980.
This is Patricia Weira-Kuhn. She's an Australian sexologist who has written extensively on gender identity and gender dysphoria.
And so there's nothing new under the sun.
Can we start by asking you, what are the different components to somebody's gender identity?
Yes, again, I would step back on that and say it's more than gender identity. When we talk of sex and gender, we talk of four categories, really. Firstly, there is biological sex. That is, what is your biology saying about who you are? So starting from your chromosomes as XX or XY, this is when you first have the fertilization in the mother's womb. And when something goes wrong there, we have the I in the LGBTQIA+. And that I is intersex. But as scientists, as sexologists, we no longer call it intersex. We call it disorders of sex development. But the reality is that's only one category, the real biology. The second category is what we've just started talking about, and that is gender identity. That is your core feeling of who are you, who you are, male, female, something in between, who knows what I am questioning. That's that identity. And if your identity in your brain feeling, that is, this is who I feel I am, isn't in keeping with what your actual biological gender says you are, that discrepancy in the presence of distress is what we call gender dysphoria. The word dysphoria meaning distress. So people can have gender identity concerns where there's a disjunct without actually being distressed. That's why transgender is such a large umbrella term. Then, of course, we have the whole area of same-sex sexuality. And even that is incredibly complex. And the fourth one is gender role. How do you present yourself to the world? When we are talking gender identity and transgender, we are only picking one part of this big spectrum of sex and gender.
Obviously, this is really complicated. I want to ask you about the idea of gender as purely a social construct. You know, we know historically that something like pink is for girls and blue is for boys, that's just cultural convention. What do you make of this idea that gender might be entirely constructed?
Again, it's a complex statement because the current research tells us that we don't really know what's happening in the brain. There's so many areas that we're looking at. You see, we look at the brain, the development in the uterus. Is there a possibility that actually developmentally you can have a disjunct between your genital development and your brain development? There's a lot of research going around there. Is it hormones? Is there a critical time of hormone masculinization of the brain? Is it possible that there is some intrauterine immune theory, which is being worked on actually in same-sex sexuality? There's so many theories that look at, is there a biological basis? So we really don't know whether it is only social construction. Is there something that tends towards an innate characteristic? The best we can say in the research today is that it is some nature, nurture working together. But as a Christian, I would say that, look, the Bible is clear on gender binary, male and female, God created them.
Are you willing to hazard a kind of guess as to what's going on there? Is there a sense for you that, you know, some of this could be attributed to construct more than others? What's your sense of it?
My sense really is that ever since, you know, I've been working in the area, which is, as I said, in 1980 in Hawaii. And I used to actually help my professor run his transgender clinics. They were not called transgender clinics. They were called gender identity clinics. And I used to meet people who were truly distressed and didn't want to feel this way. So it's not necessarily that it's somebody who just decides, I think I'm going to change. I'm sure some people do. And I'm sure there are. So we don't know for sure. But the best statistics we have in terms of clinic attendance is that one in about 10 to 30,000 in the general population would have actual gender dysphoria. So if I was hazarding, I would say that it is something maybe in our nature.
Right. So you would then therefore think of certainly gender dysphoria as a function of a fallen world. Is that right?
I would say it is, but there is also a great nurturing element in there, which is what makes me so anxious, and you ask me for my opinion, makes me so anxious as to what we're doing to children. Because now we know the science of what we call neuroplasticity. This is very clear now that what we feed into the brain will affect our wiring, our attitudes, our values, and our behavior. So, and this is particularly so that in children and teenagers, the brain is sort of changing very rapidly. And what we feed into the brain is going to affect the wiring. So we're taking these vulnerable young brains and we are subjecting them to a value base that says you are not necessarily what your genitals are, but you can imagine, you can be whoever you want to be. I had a youth worker from church say that a year six girl had said that her teacher said that, you know, you can be whoever you think you are. You are not your genitals. And one of the year six, this is year six kids, puts her hand up and says, I think I'm a robot. And the teacher had said, well, that is a possibility.
Okay, so Patricia, you have real concerns then about the way children are being taught about gender. What in your mind would be the best way to talk about this? Because there are, of course, some people who truly do experience this dysphoria, as you call it.
The best research we have says that about 5% of kids are gender non-conforming or gender variant in their behavior. Of these, a small proportion would actually fit into the diagnostic category of gender dysphoria in children. Okay? So, a small proportion. These are the ones who wouldn't, like I said, say something like, I want to be a boy, but would say something like, I am a boy. Mommy, can I get back into your womb and come out as a boy? Now, of this group who actually fit into that diagnostic category, less than 20% stay that way to adolescence and above. So there is a danger in early diagnosis, early transition, which is being done now. A definite danger.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. If you've just joined us, we're speaking with sexologist Patricia Wirikoon about gender dysphoria.
Do you sense, because there's a kind of an inclination in our culture to do our best to include people, to be compassionate towards people, and I think there's at least some of that motivation going on in here. How then do you recommend, as a society, we approach this question?
I think the first thing is to truly understand, like we've been discussing, what's happening. You know, that for some people, it's a true dysphoria. However, it is something that we need to have a very clear diagnostic categories for. So we do have clear diagnostic categories. There's the World Association of Transgender Health, who the WOPATH, who put out clear categories of diagnosis management, secular body, whose work is to do that. And so we have that. So to understand that. The second, and now I would speak from my Christian point of view, is that as Christians, we understand that, look, we live in a world where things are misaligned. And we need, while we understand that misalignment and have a deep compassion for whatever age, people and their families who are struggling with this. Because remember, gender dysphoria is not an individual concern. It is a relational concern because your identity affects those you are in relationship with, your family, your children, your wife, your husband, your parents. So we have a deep compassion for that person and their family. But as Christians, we hold on to that conviction of what the Bible teaches us, of the binary male-female. And that's a difficult line to tread. But I think it is a line that we have to tread.
Where does that leave the person, though, who's genuinely experiencing gender dysphoria? I imagine in a pretty difficult place.
A very difficult place. I'm going to speak as a Christian here, and we have somebody who's struggling with gender dysphoria. Okay, let me give an ideal way. An ideal would be that we would help that person live the best life they could in the body that God has given them, looking at, I'm created this way and I will live the best way I can. But that, for some people, may actually be impossible.
What are, Patricia, some of the ways forward for people who have experience?
Well, as a Christian, I wish that we could help everybody accept where they are and live the best life they could. For some people, it may be impossible. And for them, what I would like us to be helping them to do is live two things. One, firstly, consider the relationship they're in. And two, then do a minimally invasive way to deal with their dysphoria. There's the treatment, per se, involves in younger children, like if they're approaching adolescence. The treatment involves what they call the puberty suppressing. So you put off puberty. And then, so in other words, giving them a little time to make up their mind. And then if they're still wanting the change, still fitting in the gender dysphoria, then there's the cross-gender hormones. And then finally, the surgery. Well, as adults, you basically go into the hormones and surgery directly. So that's the treatment. But again, I would say minimal invasive in terms of relationship.
So what about in terms of community and other people, their relationships? How can communities embrace transgender people and help them to live, as you say, their best life?
I would say the best advice we can give people is that compassion and community is the most important thing. In the transgender community and those with same-sex sexuality, the reality is that suicide and mental concerns about 4 times higher than the general community. We need to be aware of that. And therefore, we need to be deeply compassionate to that the person and the relationship, the family they are in. But with that compassion, as Christians, we need to have the courage of our convictions and the ability to speak to that person and to the family in a way that says, this is the way the Bible speaks to gender and sexuality. But let us walk with you in dealing with this issue.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart and Natasha Moore. If this conversation about gender identity has brought up any questions for you, if it's caused any distress, please call Lifeline. They're on 13 11 14. They also have an online chat service at lifeline.org.au.
Now, we also have an extra interview at the end of this podcast. It's with a transgender woman, Joan. We haven't used her real name to protect her privacy. She talks about her experience here of gender dysphoria and what it's like to live as a transgender woman. If you want to know more about the lived experience of transgender people, do keep listening.
Joan, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us.
No problems. My pleasure.
Can you begin by telling us, when did you first realise that gender identity was an issue for you?
One of my earliest memories was being lectured by my parents in front of our neighbours about what is the difference between a boy and a girl and this and that and da-da-da.
Joan is a transgender woman.
I remember being...
She started experiencing gender dysphoria when she was pretty young.
So I think it really... The rubber really hit the road when I got to primary school. So that's when the boys wear one uniform and the girls wear another. And it's very apparent. All the girls have long hair and the boys have short hair, and because they're dressed in different uniforms, they separate into different groups more readily and all of this stuff. And I don't think I was adjusting very well. And my memory of this one particular event was that my mum came and picked me up from school. Something was wrong. She took me outside the gate of the school and bit down as hard as she could on my hand and yelled at me, "That is what you get. That is what it feels like when you bite somebody." And then we stormed off. And she tells me later that the reason that was because I had been attacking girls in my class, biting them on the back and drawing blood. And the only way I can think to explain that would be jealousy. Like, I was just jealous of them
being able to be girls.
Yeah. And then I remember coming back to school and trying my best to be a good little boy, and as I behaved, then the teacher put me in the play and made me the Prince Charming in the little play that we did, and I performed that in front of all the parents and
stopped biting people.
Then my whole school life became about being the good little boy student, and that colored the rest of my school life through to high school. And
I feel like, I mean, this is quite difficult for people to grasp what it actually feels like for you. I think because, I mean, a lot of people don't really think about what it means to be the gender they are. You know, I might think about like social expectations on women or sexism or something, but I don't think about what it feels like to be female. I don't even know if it's possible, but can you describe a bit what that disjunction feels like?
It's not easy to explain, but what I do know is that I have anxiety if I don't express myself as female. I can't function in life that way. And before it was a conscious expression for me, there were subconscious expressions. I would have behaviors and habits which I hid, which I kept to myself, to express who I was. And I would also make up fictional ways of expressing it, and related those to things, actual things in real life, to help me cope. So, for example, I had, out of my male wardrobe, I had clothes which I considered maybe a little bit more feminine than the other clothes, and I would prefer those clothes, and I would buy clothes that were sort of edging that way, or that, you know, I would invent some association of gender with particular items, and no one else knew, but that was what I needed to do to function.
These behaviours that had remained a secret for much of her life became almost impossible to hide.
It wasn't until these secret behaviours that I had that I used to cope, until I had in-laws come and stay with us and I had zero privacy. There was a point in time where I had no privacy at all, and then I couldn't engage in some of these activities, and it really made me stop and think, why do I need these things to cope? What is it about these things that makes them so important for my life? And so I started to ponder and to think what that was. And after some months, I started to think, okay, maybe I'm transgender. And what does that mean? And I mean, I didn't really understand. I'd heard through conversations and just through word of mouth, you know, I had a vague understanding through pop culture about what transgenderism was, but I didn't really know. And so I started to look into it, and understand what it was. And when I started to do that, I came with the approach that I wanted to rule it out. I really didn't want it to be true for me. And so I was trying to find some smoking gun, some clear indication that I could just say, nope, that's not me. And then I could, move on and look at some other possibility. But the more I looked into it, the more it was exactly who I was.
So you found it was describing everything you were experiencing.
Yeah. I was also looking for maybe something physical or physiological that could explain it as well. And so, you know, I read something which is, I'm nearly certain, totally untrue, but I read that the shape of a woman's arm is that the elbow joint is a different shape to nurse children, and so then I was checking out my own arms and I'm like, no, this can't be true, it can't be true. Yeah, I mean,
everyone who's listening is reaching for the elbow now.
But I mean, I was just really, really panicked and trying to understand, you know, whether this could really apply to me. And slowly over a 3 or 4 month period, I just realized, no, this is really true. The logical part of my brain was telling me, this is true, this is who you are, and the emotional side of me is going, no, it can't be true, this is going to ruin my life.
So what did you do from there?
So after one particularly bad panic attack, I decided that I would go and see my GP. I had to tell somebody. I had to get it off my chest and say something. And I knew that I wouldn't be able to get the words out, so I actually Googled how to tell somebody. And found some really good advice. Write it down on a bit of paper. If you can't get the words out, you just hand over the bit of paper and rely on the other person's ability to read your note.
That's what you did?
That's what I did. I took a note to my doctor.
And what sort of response did you get?
Just sympathy. My beautiful doctor said, oh, like she was just very sympathetic, empathetic, and it was exactly what I needed at that moment.
Eventually, Joan also told more people in her life, starting with her minister at church and then her wife.
Yeah, how long had you been married?
We were married 3 years. 3 years at that point, yeah.
Obviously, that must have been an incredibly difficult conversation and a difficult time. How did people respond, including your minister and your wife?
It was very difficult for my wife. And it's the pain I've caused her is something that I really regret.
Were you hoping that it would be possible for you guys to stay married? Was there the possibility of that working out at the time?
Yeah, and that was always my hope. I mean, nobody wants to get divorced. And when I first came to the realization of my identity, or first accepted my identity and told my minister and told my wife, I didn't plan on transitioning. I mean, I didn't plan on transitioning. I didn't know what I wanted. I just had learned a big truth about myself, and I wanted the marriage to stay together more than I wanted to express publicly my gender. We tried for more than 18 months to really see how we could live together with knowledge of this truth about me and my identity. And sadly, it didn't work out.
After the breakdown of her marriage, Joan's focus turned to her mental health.
After 2 months, I realized that I was in this physiological pattern where I would sleep for 4 or 5 days and then be up and active for 1 or 2 days, and really hyperactive for 2 days. And then I would crash and be in bed for another week, basically. And this cycle was getting stronger and stronger.
Joan's psychiatrist called it the anxiety trap, and she needed to find a way out.
It was at that point that I realized that the real thing that was driving my anxiety was how I was living in the male gender, basically. It was how I was expressing my gender identity.
So what did that process of transitioning, what did that involve for you?
So at first I made the decision to go on to hormone replacement therapy, where you take drugs, you take female hormones and also drugs to suppress male hormones. Just the decisiveness of making that decision and doing something active to resolve the situation resolved my anxiety nearly immediately. And so I started to function normally again. It only lasted a few months, though, and then I realized that it wasn't just the decision of taking hormones that I needed, but I also needed to take the decision to express myself as a female in public as well. Because every time you go outside, the way you dress, the way you do your hair, the way you talk, everything is flavored by gender, and to constantly choose the gender that doesn't match your identity is just really difficult. And so my anxiety came back, the cycle came back, and I had to pick apart again what was causing me to go into this sleep hyperactivity cycle. I started to present as female in public.
And did that feel better? Or did you suddenly feel?
Well, it did again, and then I realized, yes, I'm presenting as female in public, but not in front of anyone I know. And so then every time I went to meet some friends or see some family, I would still have to make these choices. And eventually it led me into the same cycle again. So it wasn't until I decided to share this information with the close people around me. And then gradually I needed to share that with more people. And then gradually I needed to transition fully in work, at church, in all areas of my life.
For Joan, being a Christian, her faith and her relationship with God was also an important factor here.
I mean, I did know that my minister had walked through this path with others before. However, I just wasn't certain. And, you know, whether my minister accepts me or not is one thing, but what the really important thing is whether God accepts me. And it was in that 6 months leading up to really telling anybody that I was also wrestling with that, you know. Not only will it ruin my life, what does this mean, you know, for my relationship with God? Yeah, I was worried about that.
And tell us how that's been, that side of it, your faith, your sense of your relationship to God since you've moved and transitioned.
My faith in God, I would not know. I can't imagine what my faith in God would be like apart from this experience. I know so strongly God's love and grace for me through, and demonstrated quite clearly through the love and the kindness shown through his people. The people in my church community have just loved and cared for me relentlessly and graciously. And to me, that's the strongest indication of God's love for me and my relationship with God. Yeah, is how his people have cared for me.